Welcome to the RSP Cast, episode 40. I am Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, and joining me once again is the Scouting Academy Director, Dan Hatman. Dan, welcome to the show again.
Oh, goodness. So thankful to be back. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure. You know, Dan does terrific work over at the Scouting Academy. If you're someone who is interested in either becoming a scout or interested in studying the game in depth, so that you get a really strong base of knowledge about what you're looking at on the field. You know, Dan's curriculum is one that I would recommend. And, you know, I would recommend you to go check out the Scouting Academy. And I know that Dan is very accessible. You can find him on Twitter and get his, you know, and ask him some questions. And I'm sure that he'll be able to put you in touch with more resources in terms of helping you kind of get an idea of what it is that you'd like to do in the direction you'd like to go there. Dan, you know, one of the things I want to talk about with you today is that you do a really fine annual piece at Inside the Pylon. That's the NFL General Manager Candidate Study, where you just research, you know, a list of a variety of candidates for GM jobs at this time of the year and moving forward, and you break it down into different categories. And I thought it'd be fun for us to talk about general managers as we head into draft season and kind of give our audience an opportunity to just kind of think about some higher end things and kind of tie that back to the actual scouting of players as we move forward into the season. So, you know, one of the first things I'd love to do is just ask you about, you know, you talked about the potential skills that a GM requires. Could you, you know, introduce us to some of the things that you had on your list, as well as, you know, color in a little bit more if you have more detail that you'd like to share?
No, I'd be happy to. Do a little bit of the background. So when I was getting my master's degree, and, you know, it was, hey, you got to write a thesis paper. I only want to write about football. And having worked for the Giants at that point and then gone to business school, I was still desperately aspiring to become an NFL general manager, right? That was the focal point. So what better way to understand, you know, what I was looking to get into than to understand what is that job? What are those duties, responsibilities? Who has the job now? And then look back, what's the track record in the background of people that have been getting that job? What are the trends that we're seeing? And so I did end up, you know, completing that work. We actually got it published. It's in the Villanova Law Journal. I actually think Andrew Brandt was the managing editor of that at the time. Not that he knows me or my paper, but interesting little football world wraparound. But anyway, and then that really spun out because I'd done 20 years of research on GMs and their background and who had it and what kind of things seemingly owners were looking for. And so I wanted to keep up with that. And again, try to continue to understand what are we seeing? What are the trends? Because there was a period of time when Mike Tannenbaum and Howie Roseman were earning those positions that they had at that time. It was Tannenbaum with the New York Jets and Howie Roseman with the Philadelphia Eagles. The people thought it was going to move disproportionately away from quote unquote football guys into cap people with a cap background.
Yeah.
And that didn't pan out. You know, we saw that for a little bit and that dialed back. Guys like Marty Herney or Ernie Accorsi, that actually came up on the media side, newspaper, PR, befriended ownership and you know, worked into personnel and climbed the ranks that way. That path is pretty much closed off now. don't really see any indications that's going to be there. I think the John Lynch's of the world, you know, going from broadcast game analyst to GM are going to be, again, the outlier, the aberration, not the rule. And so it was, again, trying to get into that. And as you mentioned, trying to learn what is this job? And I think one of the biggest misconceptions, while the person is ultimately responsible for the selection of players and building the 90 and the 53-man rosters, the 10-man practice squad, all that kind of stuff, the job is not just evaluation. It's not just film scouting. The GM spends in kind of texting out to people in those roles, about 40% less time watching film once they hit the executive tier, let alone the GM tier, than they did when they were a scout.
Yeah.
So most of the time, the scouts are actually watching more film and passing that information along. It's critical that they be able to communicate their findings to the executive tier and the general managers, because maintaining a roster, not just constructing it once, but maintaining it throughout the course of the year, takes a lot of legwork. You know, every time a player gets injured and you want to address somebody from someone else's practice squad, there are mechanisms. You have to submit things to the league and paperwork that needs to be done and agents that need to be called and all these things that take time away from just sitting in a room with a remote watching film. Obviously deciding on compensation, being a part of those negotiations, traveling with ownership, meeting with fans, having to meet with the media, although GMs meet with the media less than coaches do. There's still some media responsibilities and things of that nature. So the job is robust. You're, again, managing your coaching staff and their needs throughout the year, making sure they're supported. You're managing your scouting staff. It really is a broad-based leadership position. You're in charge of hiring doctors, and trainers, and video staff, understanding what those jobs are, how to find those people, what do those people need to do, and staying on top of that. I mean, it really is a true top-to-bottom personnel job. And there's 150 some odd people at ballpark. You talk about all your players, all your coaches, all your scouts, again, doctors, trainers, weight room staff, equipment staff, analytics staff, video staff. I mean, easily get to 150 people. You're responsible for figuring out, do we have the right people? Do they have the right equipment? Do they know what to do? Are they good at what they do? Are they better than our competition at what they do? Do we need anything else? And so this goes back to, like, when we talk about coaches. For a long time, we've discussed coaches and recognized the fact that just because you're a good coordinator absolutely does not guarantee you'll be a good head coach, right? We have copious examples of very productive coordinators not being able to be a head coach and then returning to the coordinator ranks and being very successful again. Same thing to me applies with general manager. Just being a good scout does not make you a good GM. Like, there might be a Peter principle. There might be a point where you get promoted past what you're good at. Maybe you're really good at setting the board. Here are the players. Then somebody else might be better at determining market value. Somebody else might be better at negotiating with agents. And either if you are the GM in that case, you need to delegate and truly trust somebody else to handle that and get out of the way. Otherwise, I think you're potentially doomed to failure.
Yeah, because management skills, I mean, really, it's funny that the word general manager, I mean, to a T, I mean, it's a generalist trade in a sense, because there's so many things that you, and really, I don't even know if generalist is a great word for it. You might even not want to go the opposite route, because there are so many specific skills that you need to have in your, you know, kind of in your backpack or in your tool chest to be able to apply. And then at the same time, the management skills that you just mentioned make so much sense. I mean, I think about, I mean, on a totally different career and different level, but, you know, I worked in a call center environment. And in call center environments, they're kind of interesting and chaotic, because you have to master all this scheduling, you know, of having people available to be there to answer calls for your clients. And there are certain peak hours and there are certain hours that are not. And you're usually dealing with people who have their own lives and their own schedules. And sometimes they're part-time, which means that you have a lot of work that has to be done with that. You have to do a lot of training of people, the recruiting end of the spectrum, the client services end of the spectrum. And then there's just the operations of people, you know, maintaining that they're doing their job well and figuring out what their needs are as well. And when you have to put all that kind of thing together, if you start in the way a lot of these types of industries and other industries we look at, you know, work, a lot of times people get promoted into those roles. And I was one of those people. I mean, I got promoted into a role, and it becomes, you know, you have to master different skills that you might not have even remotely had, you know, to be competent at that job. And I can look at that GM job and think it's just, you know, there's a certain point where you have to look at this and say, this I'm not very good at, but I can find people who really are, who I can trust. And I know that I can at least ask the right questions to make sure everything's going smoothly and let them delegate that and let them handle this. And then I can focus my strengths in these areas. And then these are areas where I know I can improve and must improve to become competent or good at these types of things. So, you know, thinking about the different skills you talked about, you know, evaluating talent, the financial end, the management end in terms of interpersonal skills, as well as making tough decisions and being strategic, and then also all the detail that you mentioned, dealing with detail. How would you prioritize these skills if you could just build a GM? You know, if you could just kind of like he was a Jenga puzzle and you could like, you know, build them all together and kind of have the different priorities of things, which things would you give greater weight to? And then what are things that you think you could say, you know what, I can find someone who could be like my right-hand woman or man to like do this type of work for me, and they can be my go-to person here. And so when this, you know, when these types of issues happen or this daily or weekly type of work occurs, I can just look at them and go, you're on. And then when somebody asks me a question, I can just point to that person. And if I have any real questions, I can ask and know that I trust that person to do their gig. How would you construct all that?
I think I'm going to probably have a little different take than maybe you'd anticipate from the standpoint of, so when someone goes in one of those GM interviews, they're preparing what's affectionately referred to as their book, right? A plan. And they present it to ownership. Here's how I'd go about head coaching. Here's how I'd go about quarterback. Here's my grading scales, how I'd want my staff, you know, all the different things. And obviously the people interviewing will ask questions, and you want to have your book built to want to present on all the anticipated questions, right? So I think one of the hard things is that when you go in and you sell a vision like that to an owner, and then you get selected, they say, you know what, I buy into that vision. We would hope that someone would still be open to new information, right? New ideas, the idea of changing potentially processes, what have you, to continue to find improvement. I do get the sense that sometimes, you know, you sell this vision, like ownership is now holding you to like, well, you told me you could execute that. Like, why do you need to change?
Right.
So to me, I would want someone that doesn't necessarily present like this is the way it is and has to be, and you know, I'm inflexible to it. To me, it's less about the rigidity of like knowing prior to getting the job how to do it, because again, unless you've been the GM, you don't know how to do it. Yeah. I mean, everybody that gets into it learns on the fly, and so many of these people that I've talked to that have, you know, worked their way up and they finally get to that chair, and I'm like, you know, did you feel prepared? They're like, no, like, you know, I thought I was in on decision making. I thought I got it. Like, I thought I'd spent enough time around the GM to get the job. I didn't get the job. I had no idea. You know, I was so many things that hit me sideways early on in the process that to me, I'd be looking for a couple of traits. I want someone that has a true process for evaluating people. Yeah. Because we can all have a little different value sets and skill sets that we're looking to acquire. But at some point, whether you have to hire the assistant video guy, or you're looking for a starting middle linebacker, or you need a Southeast area scout, like, you need to understand how to find people with more than just my gut. Like, what, how do you identify people that you want to bring into your organization? To me, that's first and foremost. The second thing I'd look for in a GM is, what is your process? What is your plan for continual self-scouting and improvement? This is not a rigid business. This is not one set in stone. The target's constantly moving. The rules change. Teams adapt. Players change. Personalities and temperaments of different generations change. So how are you keeping up with the times? What is your plan for self-evaluation and improvement? And then because of that, you know, I would anticipate that if you're pushing someone down that path, that they have, again, they're open to being proven wrong.
Yeah.
The idea that I went into it thinking this. With the information I had, I thought X. You presented new information, now I think Y. Like, to me, that's rational thought.
The presumption of rational general management.
And it'd be for anybody, right? In any field, but particularly at this one, it'd be the idea that, yes, with this information, I thought X. Like, and be open to that. And be able to be accountable to the fact that, listen, we got different information. And then, okay, so what was wrong with your process? Why did you not have that information in a timely manner? And then work on those things. And I don't think we can improve unless we have that level of honesty with ourselves, with the people that we're going to be hiring and empowering to do their jobs. Like, across the board, this can't be a scared, cover your ass business. It has to be one of collectively. Again, if you're going to dial back, and let's just go ahead and bump it to 50%. If you're going to cut back on 50% of your film, then that information that you would have collected on your own now has to come to a different source. You better get that source up on the par, up on the page where you were, right? If you were the best film evaluator and that's why you got the job, and all of a sudden now you don't have that time, who is filling that? Who are you training to be the best film evaluator to get you that information?
That's great. And it makes total sense because, again, you cannot do everything yourself when you're managing, you know, an operation of that kind of broad expanse. And you have to understand that you've got to be able to teach other people. The best thing that you can do as a manager is to create people who are ready to take over your job, who are ready to succeed you, who can do your job, you know, and do various aspects of it, at least, you know, who can be in that position and see things with that kind of clarity. And that, you know, that comes in obviously involved with picking the right people who have the kind of mindset that you're looking for, who can grow. But at the same time, too, it doesn't mean that every single person you pick has to have that type of potential. I mean, you can pick people and say, I know this person's probably going to be a lifer in this type of job, if as long as we have, you know, a football life here in this town, in this role, that they do that better than anybody or as well as anybody. And that's their thing. And they're good with that. You know, if you've identified people like that, that's great. But I also I'm totally with you, is that you can't have gotten the job for one thing and now you're going to be doing something a lot different and then have a gap there. And I think the patience factor that underscores this is probably the thing that is also the assumption of rational ownership, which is that you would have some patience with growth and what comes with growth. Comes with, you know, all these things you talk about with learning is usually from making mistakes. And, you know, in this business, it sure seems like from the outside in that, you know, that mistakes are very costly, you know, to people in these roles, and that there's not a lot of level of adjustment that's given for some of those mistakes. And as a result, growth doesn't always happen. When they're just about ready to grow and see results of that growth, sometimes they're out on the street. I mean, what would you comment to that? When I'm talking about patience factor, are you looking at me and going, yeah, that would be nice, right?
I think there are ownership groups that will allow for their football people to manage upwards. And I think there are ownership groups that won't. And I think that's a distinguishing factor in results. And one of those things that, you know, for example, like the NFL is really bad at hiring a GM for a second time, right? Other than like your Bill Polians, Ernie Accorsis, and there was tremendous success somewhere else. Then, you know, they're made available and they get, you know, go to a new team. We don't do a lot of retreads. And right now, with how intently the game is studied and analyzed, when someone, you know, fails as a general manager, they are talked about like they should never look at football again. Like we should just go ahead and take their television out back and break it in half, gouge their eyes out. I mean, I'm not kidding. Like people talk about these former GMs like they, you know, they don't know anything. They must be the dumbest human being in the history of the world.
Right.
And I certainly can't defend every decision that is made and try to say that, oh, I would have made the same ones or whatever else. But until you have that owner meeting with you weekly, telling you what the numbers are, telling you what the expectations are, telling you if this doesn't get right, I'm going to do this. If this doesn't right, you can't hire that person. You know, I don't, you might like that coach. I don't. I want you to hire this coach. So that's the hard part about analyzing this from the outside, is that we just sometimes don't know what parameters, what constraints were set up in that building that will never become public if that person has tact, right? Unless they come out and just blow the doors off the thing afterwards, you're usually not going to get that kind of look inside. I think the only time I've ever seen that look inside was when Ted Sundquist wrote that piece a few years ago about being in Denver. And even that I don't think was necessarily inflammatory on all parts. It just was a pull back the curtain and really show you what it was like. So other than that, I mean, other than my anecdotal experience actually being in buildings for all these other teams, I don't necessarily know what constraints that owner put on. And I think that becomes a really difficult part. So if you have a group where they'll allow you to manage up, I think that gives a gym a really good chance to be the best version of themselves. But I don't know that we necessarily get the best version of every GM, because if they were to drop optimal decision-making in a vacuum, it may not match what they ultimately do, because they're not working in a vacuum. I mean, when you walk in the building, we talked about those 150 people. When you walk in the building, 100 of them are probably under contract.
Yeah.
And are you allowed to move them all? Do you even know how to replace them all day one? And you have to learn about those people and manage them as you're learning about them, but taking information that you have to activate on while you're learning about them. And maybe they were favorites of the owner, or maybe they're the owner's nephew's kid, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's so many of these things that people are like, well, I don't understand how they could do that. I would never do that. You don't know that. Yeah. You weren't in those shoes. You had no idea what you would or wouldn't do until your $1.5 million a year job is constrained by the fact that this guy who's a billionaire tells you, yeah, I don't want you to do that.
Exactly. And it's such great points, and they relate to the real world. I mean, when you go out in the working world and you deal with some of these things, it's funny because, I mean, and they relate to just basic football. I mean, Jerry Rice dropped a lot of passes his rookie year, some key passes his rookie year. Did they fire him? You know, I mean, it's one of those things that we actually allow more growth, I think, in some cases with, you know, certain levels than we do others. And I mean, with managing people or the different constraints that you have, it can create situations that are just crazy. I mean, I'll give you an example just from my own life that I think is has always been kind of a story that gets people laughing. And I'll share it with you for the first time is, you know, when I was in college, I had a part-time job for a company just working in a telemarketing company. We sold children's books. And I worked for this branch, and all the branches were different. There were probably about 60 or 70 branches across the United States doing this way back in the day. And we sold little golden books, you know, and I'm sure you're familiar with those. Sure. Having some kids, right? You know, so we sold those, and I was a good salesperson on the phone, and I did well, and I became a supervisor part-time. And most of us were college students at that time doing that. And we were told by our manager of that branch who, you know, ended up not being he wasn't a very good manager. I would say he took means that probably weren't the best means to make, and it didn't work out for him long term. But while I was there, I remember him talking about that they needed to fulfill a budget and fulfill a role of how many people they had on staff to be able to get through all of the leads that they had. So we were responsible for hiring people. And when that was going on, he told me in the interview, if people made some mistakes with reading, you know, scripts and weren't exactly on point with some of the things, had some pronunciation issues or missed a word here or there during the interview, and you seemed like they could be reliable, bring them in. You can soften the requirements of what you're doing. You know, I mean, and actually encouraged that we should do that. So I did. And I hired somebody who, you know, seemed to take a little bit longer in what they were doing and had some issues with pronunciation and reading certain words. And we're going through the shift, and we had finished, you know, training this person, and we were selling Stephen King's book, Insomnia. That became like, that was one of the things that was like a smaller program. It wasn't just children's books. We ended up doing like, you know, Time Life books and some other things. So we were offering a free preview of Insomnia to join the Stephen King book club. And one of my coworkers just starts looking around, really kind of disgusted and kind of trying not to laugh either, and looks at and goes, who hired so-and-so? Like kind of went around quietly and did that in the room. And he looks at me, and I go, it was me. And he goes, come back here. And we go back there, go into the room and listen. And this woman who I hired was getting hung up on for an hour, just like straight, like nobody would talk to her for more than 15 seconds. And the reason was that she was mispronouncing the word insomnia. She was offering Stephen King's Insodomy to customers. And they were literally, like, we don't do that kind of thing around here. And basically hanging up over and over again. So after I got through my embarrassment and had to go work with her, I learned a valuable lesson on just the idea of, one is that, you know, God, I must really stink at hiring people and being a supervisor of people. I mean, you know, I was like in my early 20s and not, you know, and how could I hire someone who couldn't pronounce insomnia and they kept trying to sell insodomy to everybody. But I learned very quickly, you know, it's just like you get better at what you do. And sometimes you make some awful mistakes, you know, and it doesn't doom you. But in a profession that's higher pressure and that's highly paid, it becomes the pressure and the expectations sometimes are high and they should be high, but sometimes they're even outsized for what they should be.
Yeah, like it's just so difficult because you don't have an opportunity to learn this, right? There's nothing but on the job training. You know, the NFL's career advisory panel puts on an annual symposium. I believe it's 3 days. There's speakers. They talk about things. I think that's a great step. By no means am I belittling that, but at the same time, did any of us learn our particular job in 3 days?
No.
And if we ever went into management, did you learn how to manage that division properly in 3 days? No. So the hope is that you're learning prior to, right? If you're an owner, right? If you're hiring with these guys, you're hoping they come in knowing what to do. So you're coming with this assumption that they've learned how to be a GM before they were a GM and that they had to have learned it in their previous organization. So wouldn't that necessitate some sort of understanding as does that GM actually train his people on how to do that job?
Yeah.
And is there any incentive for an existing GM to train your senior lieutenants to go become your closest competitors?
No, not at all. You know,
other than like, if you like them and you know, what have you, but there's none. Yeah. I think to me, it would seem the incentive structure for a current GM is I want you to be the best possible college director. I want you to be the best possible pro director. I want you to be the best possible whatever and train you to do that. But again, other than soliciting your advice or counsel or talking about certain things, why do I have an incentive as an existing GM to teach you how to do my job? Yeah. Because there's only one of me and I'm not going to go on leave. So I don't need to be replaced. So you'd have to go somewhere else. And again, then I'm teaching you my strategies to do this job. And then you'd be my closest competitor applying those. Yeah. And so I just wonder if there's not a fundamental mistake in the assumptions that we make about how these people are trained and developed. And if you're an ownership group, how are you verifying that this person knows how to deal with all those scenarios ahead of time? You know, in this, it comes back to your information gathering. So much of this is just how well do you know people? Do you know these organizations? You know, the people that are in them. You know, if I'm hiring a coach, I have objective evidence. Andy Reid really does spend time training his coaches on how to be head coaches.
Yeah.
Because they're all over the league. Not just the last couple of years. It's not just Doug and Matt Nagy. It's Ron Rivera. It's John Harbaugh. You know, his tree is expansive. So whatever you want to say about coach, he absolutely spends time training his people. So, you know, if I'm looking at a coach in this cycle, I'm looking at anybody affiliated with Andy Reid and his tenure, because clearly he's working to equip at least some of them with the right skills to do that. I don't know if you can say that about every head coach. Yeah. I don't know if you can say that about every GM. So to me, that seems like a low hanging fruit jumping off point for research on like who does a really good job, who really cares about their people to bring them along. And if there's not, then should the owners be getting together like they did with the career advisory panel and saying, we need to make sure there's a better training protocol for the people taking over our organizations. You know, the owners do get together and do things league wide that behoove everybody. So maybe they need to spend a little more time on that side and verify that they're doing everything they can to make sure the candidate pool is as robust and trained and developed as possible So there is less on the job training. There is less stress and agita over trying to figure out how to do this, and more of just, we hired this guy who's really smart, really capable, and they're hit the ground running.
Yeah. And I think that there's two things I'd like to comment about this. I mean, I think one is that it would be great if they did that league wide and looked at what could be better for the league. But I could see how the counter argument might be, well, you know, that's great for the better of the league, but what about my team right now? Sure. What about what's going to happen now? And the impatience factor that kind of bleeds into that. So they'll have to at least overcome a good argument to be able to say, look, this is better for the league. This will be better for everyone. And I think that that can be an argument that can be made and be compelling. And the other point that I think too, is that as you were talking about, you know, coming in as a GM and, you know, identifying the people you're going to work with and getting an idea for what they're good at, what they're not good at, how you can work with them and how you can get them to align with your vision and what you plan on doing. You know, it's interesting because you see the opposite end of that spectrum too. And oftentimes with very popular leaders, you know, and I don't know how Bobby Knight really is, but I think of Bobby Knight and Bill Parcells. And I think of guys who are kind of like, I get the impression that they come in and they have their guys and they just kind of, they kind of plow the road of personnel and, you know, get rid of people, even if they are good, just because they're like, look, it almost seems like they're kind of like, look, I don't have time to evaluate this kind of stuff. I don't have time to get all this in place. I need results as soon as possible. So I know who my guys are. I can get my lieutenants and I can identify people who I think could be my lieutenants. But if I'm not sure, I'd rather just get rid of them and say, sorry, you're out the door, and find someone who I know can. You know, so, I mean, I don't know if that's accurate or not and what you think about that, but I would love to get your thoughts kind of on that method, as well as then, you know, before we move on and kind of talk about some of the people on your list.
I think it's difficult because, again, the condensed timelines and the immediate call to action, right? I mean, every time you have a Sean McVay-esque resurgence, it seems to stimulate an ownership that's easily available to everybody. Like, if they can get it, then I can get it. You know, I have $1 billion. If they can get that, I want that. And that's not always the case. It's not always available. So either with, again, the limitations in the candidate pool, or simply, again, if you were to design any of these things in a vacuum, I don't think we'd come up with anything on the hiring, especially of a general manager like we do. I mean, just take the sheer timeline. So GM's given, what, 3 years, right? We start assessing their viability 3 years in, even though we always talk about even their first draft class can't really be evaluated for somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 years to monitor for development. But over the past few years, by the third year, GMs are starting to get into the hot seat like a coach would. So that means immediately your first class needs to be a hit, and then your subsequent ones obviously have to continue to either maintain or gain steam even from that point. So let's say you do the typical cycle of, you fire a GM after week 17. So now we're early in January, and the Senior Bowl is the last week in January, or last full week. And so you'd like to have a GM in place by then, so their people can go start evaluating this draft class. So that means that, don't get me wrong, these owners know these decisions long before week 17. So they've probably been quietly vetting candidates for 6-8 weeks, I would imagine. I don't have concrete evidence on all of them, but I would ballpark that if any, you know, GM gets let go, the owner's probably been thinking about it for 6 to 8 weeks. And so then between whatever day, the beginning of January, you make that move, and whatever day in the 20s you want to get the people to the Senior Bowl, it means most GM hiring is done within 2 week span of the quote unquote official interviews, whatever your 4, 6, 7 candidates are, bring them in, actually speaking with them, making that decision. If you have a head coaching move, to get done with that in addition, again, the timeline gets condensed because you want to have that GM to have time to do a coaching search and have that coaching staff ideally in place to go to an event like the Senior Bowl. So all of that gets rushed. That GM again has to draft a class at the beginning of May. And the scouting work that was done during the fall was done by a staff they didn't put together. So, you know, let's say Chris Ballard a couple years ago walks into Indy. He didn't hire all those guys in Indy.
Right.
But he's got to use that information in addition to whatever senior lieutenants. And in this case, he brings in Ed Dodds and Rex Hogan, Brian Decker. So he brings in his senior lieutenants, and then he's got to use whatever's in the building, filter it through his senior lieutenants to collect whatever information he feels like he needs to go ahead and draft a class. And so we condense all that timeline so we can get these people into it, because we know we have this deadline, this draft is coming. And that doesn't, I didn't even mention the fact that free agency comes before that, right? So you still have to attack that process. So that's a typical GM cycle versus what Buffalo did, which is atypical. Let Doug Whaley draft a class, then relieve Doug of his duties, then tell the new GM, you do not have to retain anybody in scouting. We will buy out the contracts of everybody. You can top to bottom hire whoever you want. In this case, they hire Brandon Bean. But you can't hire a coach. We already hired him. But you can hire anybody you want in scouting. And then you have the entire year to get that staff ready for your first draft. From a strict scouting perspective, the Buffalo model sounds better, but it doesn't allow for you to pick your coach, right?
Right.
Which sounds not ideal, because if I was to drop the ideal coach selection, you'd hire a GM. That GM would be allowed to hire a coach. And then the owner would tell those two, like San Francisco did, to my understanding, you two are a unit. You come in together, you leave together, period. And you tie those two at the hip, and they either make it work or they don't, but we're not going to have infighting. I like that. That's attractive to me.
I agree.
But no matter what, the timelines, the realities of the league calendar does not make it ideal, because, you know, it could potentially take me 3-4 months maybe to do the right coaching search if I did all my due diligence and interviewed candidates and did background and yada, yada, yada. Maybe that'd take me longer. And then, you know, get that done, start to build my scouting staff, vet people across the league. And then when all that's ready, say, okay, now I'm ready to start scouting players. But that's not the reality. And I think that's the tenuous part of all this, is that the way the calendar's set up and then the expectations that the paying public has for results don't allow for best practice. You know, I listen to people analyzing the league, and many of them are very intelligent, and I don't disagree with what they're trying to say on the whole, but they assess these people and treat them like they're idiots. And I'm going, this isn't sitting around and deciding who my favorite tight end is.
Yeah. Just because, you know, I mean, it's that kind of thing where it's like, just because you're witty, intelligent, and can write a good sentence and may have some experience in a certain area of the world doesn't make you an expert in these types of matters. And it shows in the writing and in the analysis at times, as good as they are about stuff. I mean, I laugh because I think about, as you were saying that, I even think about myself talking about, you know, what I would do if I could own an expansion team. And at least the only thing that I did was decide to say that I was going to be the owner and so that I could ultimately make the decisions enough and have at least enough common sense to say, you know, with some management experience, to know that I needed to be at the top to be able to at least implement my hackneyed vision of whatever it is that I came up with, you know, in that scenario. But it is fascinating because, yeah, you forget about all the different timelines. You might identify a coach, but not identify the GM. You might identify the GM, but not be able to identify the coach. And then, you know, if you don't have, you may have to work with what you got, like you said. And that's there are so many limiting factors to all of this that are important. And I do think that you're so on point about, we need to give retreads another opportunity, that, you know, as much as people complain about it, that it may, you know, that there's things that can be learned that first go around and that second go around that they would do a lot differently if they had the opportunity and the right environment for it.
Or at least get them interviews. I mean, we're not even seeing when the interviews work. you know, even if they ultimately don't get hired, and you feel like, you know, somebody that hasn't done that before is a better candidate. But we don't even see, again, the retread get the interviews.
I mean, but that's, you know, it's almost like they're treated like felons, you know, or people who have arrest records in the corporate world about things where you see folks not really get opportunities after they made mistakes. I mean, I've hired some people who've made some mistakes early in their life. And I found that, I mean, it's a very different thing, but it's a kind of a similar thread, is that I found that those people, when you identify the right people who've made a mistake, they're going to work their ass off for you, and they get it. Like, they understand that this is their opportunity to shine, and that may be their next real opportunity to do this again and make things right. And I would think that to a degree, someone who's really serious about wanting to have this type of career, and I would think most people are who end up doing this, if they would look back on and reflect on what they did and really want to have another opportunity, you know, and make the most of that. But they're almost treated like, well, you got convicted of X, Y, and Z. You got convicted of bad management. You know, you got convicted of a bad record. You got convicted of injuries. You got convicted of a scandal that had nothing to do with you, but some player. You are now sentenced to life being barred from having an opportunity in the NFL.
And you mentioned in there, not everybody's has worked to redeem themselves or rehabilitate or whatever terminology you want to use. So certainly not everybody that has been a GM before needs to be a serious consideration, but it seems to be like universal, like they're just not in. And I take last year with Dave Gettleman and John Dorsey as a little bit of an albatross from the standpoint of those two gentlemen were, and again, this all via media reports, but those two gentlemen were let go from their previous organizations, but it wasn't for the team building. It was for other personality concerns, and which led them back to another organization immediately. To your point, like once these guys get convicted of, you didn't build this team well, that's it and forever. And I think it's decision-making filtered through PR, right? We talk a lot when we're on the outside, and I'm a member of the outside. When we're on the outside, we talk about optimal decision making, right? What's the optimal decision? How many optimal decisions can we make? Can we increase percentages? I'm all for that, right? I'm sitting here. I understand. I get it. I love that. But we just talked about how many things are institutionally set up just via the calendar
context, optimal
decision making, let alone if you have to filter it through PR so you don't spend a cycle getting annihilated by everybody with column inches on how all the failures of the person you just hired, it's easier to just not consider them.
Yeah.
And go hire someone and sell hope because this person's never done it. There's hope. But if they've never done it, it doesn't guarantee success.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about column inches and PR and how all that works, I mean, we can go down to the coaching level and think about Bill Belichick in Cleveland versus Bill Belichick in New England. Was he really that different of a coach? Is he really that different of a personality? I'm sure he learned a lot as a coach during that time, but he's no different of a personality. It's almost quietly charming now that he's withstood the annihilation of the media about his personality. Now that when you look at it just from a fan's perspective, but back in Cleveland, you know, that people hated him. I remember being a fan back during those days with the Browns, and people hated Bill Belichick. You know, they associate him with all the PR things as opposed to what was going on inside the building. Now it's convenient in hindsight to look at that story, you know, and we can look at an NFL Films, you know, documentary on, you know, on Belichick and Ozzie Newsome and Dorsey and all those guys that went through there, Dimitroff and you know, and you get to see another side of it. So, you know, speaking of individuals, you know, you have this extensive list of who who would be possible candidates, you know, and you've tiered them by ones who've declined interviews, ones who've had multiple interviews, ones with one interview, people who are on insider lists of all the big media football insiders, and guys with previous experience. So let's kind of go from that end to the ones who declined. Who's a guy with previous experience that that you would like to see, you know, possibly get an opportunity to, for an interview?
You hear a lot about Jeff Ireland, who's now in New Orleans, and the success of the Marshawn Lattimore, Alvin Kamara draft here recently, and all the work he's done there. And you hear a lot about Scott Pioli, because he was a big candidate when he left New England to go to Kansas City. Now they're in Atlanta, and obviously minus some injuries this season, I would imagine that club would have been continued on their competitive streak. I had to drop Reggie McKenzie in yesterday. That was kind of a, I wouldn't say come out of nowhere, but didn't expect it yesterday into the mix. The one that I think is on the list that might be different, and again, it falls into a note that I drop at the top, where your team's current record becomes basically your resume. And if your team you're with is doing well, your stock is up as a candidate. If the team you're with is doing poorly, your stock gets impacted by that as a candidate. So I would imagine someone that right now with the Rams being as effective as they are, Brian Zanders, who was general manager in Denver, technically during the time where Josh McDaniels was there, would be and potentially really shouldn't be interesting to ownership, not just because of the Rams' success or because of Brian's background in the game, but Brian's also known as a football systems expert. And one of the things that has been kind of a crowning achievement for him started in Denver with the technology and the systems he put into place there long before the rest of the league started to get involved in technology and their scouting, and then was hired in Detroit. My understanding was in large part due to what they felt they needed to do institutionally to catch up to other teams in the league. And now in the Rams, and they're aggressive in their thinking. There's a lot of articles out there. If you want to read about J.W. Jordan or their director of draft management or strategy, I'm not particularly sure what J.W.'s exact title is, but basically that advances in their analytics department. To me, those kind of systems are intriguing. That's just, that's my background. That's something I'm interested in. So obviously of the names I think that are out there that'd be discussed a lot, I'd hope to see Brian on there as well.
Okay. How about some of the insider list guys that, Schefter and Rappaport and all those guys are mentioning?
Yeah, this is the part where it gets interesting, because that's where I start my research, right? It's people that have had interviews, and I try to confirm that with teams themselves and beat writers and what have you, candidates. And then that obviously creates the bulk of it, who's been interviewing. And then I have a section on who seem to be, again, like the hot names that people are discussing. And I leverage, and you mentioned those insiders and the list that they produce. Albert Breer always does a list. Adam Kaplan used to do a list. So one of the filtering things I tried to look at, again, through the lens of which teams are hot, were which teams are either seriously in the playoffs already, or locked in, or in serious consideration. And so a couple names that come to mind for me, obviously anybody that comes out of New England, people have been looking at Casario. They can't seem to get him. So the next one they're looking at, like they did with Bob Quinn when he went to Detroit, if you can't get Nick, who else can I get in New England? Monty Ossenfort, their director of college scouting. I've seen his name on lists, I think, each of the last 2 years. So I'd imagine we'll continue to see that again this year. Similarly, George Payton, who's been the assistant general manager, the number two to Rick Spielman with the Minnesota Vikings, obviously been a very productive team, great team build when you look at that roster. He hasn't always accepted interviews, been a little more active the last couple years. A few years prior to that, he was declining them. So again, if the question is, can we get George out? If you can't, I think people are continuing to be interested in Minnesota and Jamal Stevenson, who's their college director. Again, if you look at the success of the Vikings draft, I mean, just look at that defense. Look at all those first round picks. We talk so much about Kendrickson, can you hit optimal decision making, right? Yeah. Land your first round pick seems to be optimal decision making. Minnesota's first round pick success rate's very substantial, and Jamal is a big part of that. And then I think kind of the one that's been on the list, but I'm throwing in the mix this year from the standpoint of how resurgent Indianapolis Colts have been. Yeah. Under Chris Ballard is one of his right-hand men, and Ed Dodds, who he brought in from Seattle. Ed was a senior personnel executive there. He just got promoted to assistant GM in Indianapolis last year. I know there was a lot of people down on the lack of free agency moves Indianapolis made with the amount of cap space that they had. But they went in that draft and just crushed it.
Yeah. And they still got a couple guys that have yet to be seen.
Yeah. That's how good it was. You know, that team and that personnel state.
I'm waiting for Deion Kane.
Yeah. So I would imagine ownership will be taking a look at him. And there's a few other names in the list, obviously, and I don't want to discredit anybody there. And I try to mention in the list, I don't want to discredit anybody that's made a list. There are plenty of intelligent, hardworking people in this industry. It becomes a matter of stock. All this stuff's a matter of stock. The coaching lists are a matter of stock. You know, just like Anthony Lynn now with the Los Angeles Chargers, he was stuck as a running backs coach for a long, long time. And no one wanted to give him a second thought because he hadn't been a coordinator. There are some people who are not in those coordinator or director jobs, those senior ones that get the next level of buzz. There are plenty of people that are not in those jobs who would still make a great head coach or GM. And I would hope that we would do better in time about finding ways to uncover them.
Yeah. Public service announcement to anybody who might be listening. I'm putting Dan on the spot. So if any of you who know Dan or have relationships with Dan who might be, you know, people, even if you might, you know, lo and behold, be people on this list, I'm putting Dan on the spot. So I'm just asking him to just mention some people here in a quick timeline. So let's kind of move on and go with maybe some guys who have had, you know, one interview or multiple interviews. That, you know, a couple guys that maybe stand out to you that you would think, let's say, maybe may not necessarily be the best because they're all, you know, obviously guys that you've mentioned for one reason or another, but there's something about what they bring in their resume that is notable that you think would be interesting for people to know about.
Well, again, a few years ago, we had Seattle win the Super Bowl. You know, Russell Wilson was on the rookie deal, Legion of Boom, what have you. I mean, there was talk of the Seattle dynasty, and it hasn't necessarily materialized. But then we got to this year, and people were like, man, that team's going to stink, right? I mean, that was one of the public perceptions was this is a rebuilding year. They made a lot of moves. We don't know what they'll be. They've got a lot of young players. Who do they have at wide receiver? Is there anybody in the secondary that can even play? Yada, yada, yada. Yeah, they're playing ball. playing ball. They're playing well, and they keep finding players, and they keep finding scheme fits, value day three adds in addition to their premium picks. And they're
playing old man football.
They run the ball. They're two co-directors of player personnel. They've split the title. They do not have a direct number two. They've got two men in Scott Fitter and Trent Kirchner who are there splitting that. I have not had the fortune myself of working with those guys, but they have been all over the interview cycles the last couple of years. I think it's simply a matter of time, depending on what jobs are available this year or next year. I think it's simply a matter of time that one or both gets plucked out of Seattle and are running their own shops somewhere else. And same can be said for Elliott Wolf, you know, going from Green Bay to Cleveland with John Dorsey and Alonzo Highsmith. And then watching what the Browns have been this year with the new additions, you know, Elliott was a hot candidate because of the Green Bay experience and the team that they had built over time. But now to see him now with a second team and to see the second team being productive and its players being productive, I got to imagine it's only giving more credence to ownership to be like, hey, we really got to get him in and interview him.
Very cool. So how would you know, you talked about, you know, that, in the article that teams don't necessarily, you know, do broad searches or wide searches for GMs. So, you know, based on, you know, what you know, how would you like to see teams do searches in ways that they're not doing right now?
I think the hard part is that when you fire a GM, you're firing the most senior football person in the building usually, which means now this ownership tier who –
they lobotomize
in most cases, self-admittedly, is not the premium football mind in the building, has to then go decide who is the premium football mind on the market when they may not know what a premium football mind is, especially if they just hired the one before that didn't work out. It's tough. To me, ownership is the great equalizer. I don't know how else to say it. Like, it seems to be the difference maker in all this. Yeah. And it's to me, if that person is honest and says, okay, I'm not that person, I want to hire that person, who's advising you? Which has become why the consultant track has been so big lately. And that same career advisory panel we talked about before that has had the Charlie Casserly's on it, the Bill Polian's on it. I believe Tony Dungy's on it. We've seen Ernie Accorsi lead a lot of these GM searches. So these guys that have been successful GMs have been hired over and over again in the last 5-10 years to run searches for ownership to pick the next GM with the assumption that you were good at this job. You'll be able to tell me who's going to be good at this job. And the reason why I wrote that it seems like we're not necessarily getting broad is that the same consultants keep bringing very similar candidate pools to the table, right? It seemingly like the candidate, the consultant, and this could be a proper process. I don't know, but if they're good at what they do, let's say, and they've picked out, these are, I think, the best six candidates, and I brought the same six to the last guy and he hired one, and then one of them went somewhere else and one of them's not that good. Now I'm going to bring three of those same six to the next one and filter them with three more. It's just not,
and we'll have a similar look. Yeah.
It just comes back to who's advising the owner, right? So it's hard to come up with, like, what would you like to see? I would like to see good leadership, good decision-making rewarded. But again, so many times in scouts, you're not asked to make a decision. You're asked to provide insight, right? The decision maker makes the decision. So it's so hard beforehand to know who's going to be a good GM, right? That's the whole tricky part to this deal is there's no objective way. They don't do it before they do it. So there's no objective way to do this. And then the ownership tier has to hire somebody or have a good friend or a confidant or a consultant or whoever who advises you on said matters. Maybe it's that NFL panel. Again, maybe it's a former GM that retired from the team or whatever else. And they tell ownership, hey, this is what I'd be looking for. This might be the questions I'd ask. This might be the people that I'd talk to. And I think all of that ultimately leads to a narrow pool that pulls from the same places. And we've seen a lot of similarities in agents. You know, there's a few agents that seemingly their candidates magically get on everybody's lists. And so I don't know how to change that, because you're talking about ownership trying to find the top football mind and who's advising them on what a top football mind looks like.
Yeah. And that is probably the ultimate difficulty there. And it does start from the top down, all of this. So it's kind of good that we ended on that note after we looked at everything we did. And, you know, Dan, as always, this has just been a fantastic, enlightening conversation that I think everybody who listens to this podcast will enjoy. And if you aren't following Dan Hatman on Twitter and you're active on Twitter, he's available at Dan_Hatman. You can also find him at scoutingacademy.com. He is the director of scouting development there. At the Scouting Academy is the Twitter handle for the business. And, you know, Dan's worked in a scouting capacity with the Eagles, Jets, and Giants. And, you know, I definitely recommend what he does. He's someone that I think has been very helpful in this community and really wants to help people. And I think that that's something that shines through with the people who have gone through his course and rave about it. So I would highly recommend it if you're interested in learning more about the game. So Dan, thanks again for joining me.
Oh, too kind, sir. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. And for those of you who are, following the RSP, just want to thank you again for your response to the recent December newsletter. And for those of you who are new to the RSP experience and are listening to it through these podcasts, I am doing a pre-sale that I do every year, a pre-sale discount period on the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio, which is available this pre-sale period from now through December 28. You get 10% off, and you get the April 1 RSP for download, the May RSP post-draft update, and then the June through December newsletter. That's offered to subscribers for all one price of $19.95. After December 28th, those of you who stubbornly want to wait to pay the full price of $21.95, I love y'all, and you're you know, you'll be available to pre-order that up through April when it is available for download. So, you know, the response again has been great, and you can learn more about that at www.mattwaldman.com or mattwaldmanrsp.com. Thanks again for listening. Please rate and review this podcast on iTunes. If you haven't had the chance, give me some feedback so I know where I need to continue heading with it. And I hope you guys have a good holiday season the rest of your week.